you're sufficiently recuperated. Okay, so today we I'm going to continue marching through the most important metrics, and that will include our first glimpse of the only one we like them all. Some of them even are very beautiful, but there's only one that really is like, there's only one that we're really loyal to in this class, and that is the FRW metric, the cosmological metric. So we'll get to that finally, and learn a little bit about it. And then, but then before doing too much with that, I don't think you're going to learn anything about sort of the astrophysical properties of black holes, which after all is a property of, which play a role in cosmology too. So I want to just have a brief stop at the black hole metrics at the end of the lecture, and then I think I'll only get to say a very little bit about them. But then in the tutorial, just there'll be a few simple exercises to just get a little bit of familiarity with them. And then sadly, I think that's all I'm going to get to say about them. But anyway, okay. So I just wanted to say a few more things. So last time, I had time to explain to you how you get so if you want to make the maximally symmetric geometry in n dimensions, and with signature p, q, so p space-like directions and q time-like directions, well, if eta AB P comma Q, and also I should say with curvature of sine K, so K equals plus one for positive curvature, minus one for negative curvature, or zero, and curvature radius rho. So this is the analog of playing an analogous role to it's the length scale that characterizes the curvature, just like the radius of a sphere is the length scale that characterizes its curvature. And so I explained there was this very sort of, basically, that all of these space-times could just be constructed by taking the construction of the sphere and just sprinkling in a few minus signs here and there. And the result was that if this is the flat metric, the k equals zero metric, maximally symmetric metric with signature p comma q. So in other words, this is the Euclidean metric when q is zero, and it's the Minkowski metric when q is one, and it's a metric that you wouldn't want to live in when q is greater than one. Then the metric for k arbitrary, we found, was, so in the notes I call that guy, it's kind of a little bit cumbersome, but just to be clear, I call that so these up here just indicate that this is the metric with signature p comma q and sine of the curvature k, and then these are actual indices on the metric. So it's equal to the flat metric, and then plus okay, so not so bad. And this again, this is its form in quasi-Cartesian coordinates. So for a lot of applications, now, and a very important thing to say, and so again, we made this table that depending on the curvature, k equals plus one, minus one, or zero, and the signature, n comma zero, n comma one, you get all of the famous maximally symmetric spacetimes. So you get, for plus one and positive signature, you get the n-sphere. For time-like signature and plus one, you get n-dimensional De Sitter space, which I should mention just to foreshadow things. This, in addition to just being a cool space, is approximately the space, the shape that we think space-time had during an early epoch of inflation, if there was an early epoch of inflation. And it's also approximately the space, the shape that our cosmological space-time has today and is approaching if the apparent observation of dark energy really indicates that there is a that the universe has a positive cosmological constant of the observed value. So that this guy is actually quite relevant to what we're going to be talking about later. And then with minus one, this is the n hyperboloid, the anti-De Sitter and Euclidean n space and Minkowski space. And then you might wonder why we're not going down to signature, this should be n minus 1 comma 1, and why aren't we going down to signature n minus 2 comma 2 and so forth? And the answer is that the metrics below here with two or more time-like directions, apart from the fact that you I hope have not experienced two or more simultaneous directions of time, and so it does not intuitively appear to have a relevance to your description of the physical world. But nevertheless, in the spatial direction, people tell us that there might be other directions of space, 10 or 11 dimensions of space that you don't many of which you don't notice on a day-to-day basis. So why not some extra dimensions of time? The answer is that, okay, so in fact, it would be incorrect to say that these have not ever turned up anywhere in theoretical physics. But a basic reason that you don't expect to live in a space-time with multiple times, or that you have to, a basic point to make about space-times with two or more times is that if there's two time directions, in normal Minkowski space, there's a light cone here. I'm not allowed to travel faster than the speed of light. So if this is the time direction, and this is the space direction, then I can't fly a rocket ship like this because, I can fly like this because here I'm always moving slower than the speed of light, but then once I get to this quarter of the circle, I'm moving faster than the speed of light. The slope is less than 45 degrees everywhere here. And at least in this class, you're not allowed to fly your spaceship faster than the speed of light. And so that's good, because then you were born here. There's a cute little baby picture of you here, and then your grandfather was born back here, and you don't want to, you understand. But if these are both time directions, the basic obstruction here is that it is believed that the physical principle is you have to fly your rocket in a time-like direction. That's what forbids this part of your trajectory. But if these are both time directions, if this is T1 and this is T2, then even if the space is completely flat, even without having to curve it in some crazy way, you can do this thing, and that's. It's certainly morally wrong, and it's also probably physically wrong. Now I just wanted to, before going on, these spaces are sufficiently important, and in particular, there is this identity that for all such spaces, independent of the coordinate system, R, A, B, C, D is proportional to G, A, C, G, B, D. It has this very simple form, G, A, D, G, B, C. And so the proportionality constant is K over rho squared here, I think. Your problem set for the first week, problem one on it is to derive is to derive some of the equations in the first section of the notes, the maximally symmetric section, in particular this one. And so just to make sure that you don't, the key point about these derivations is that if you find that they're taking like tons and tons of algebra, you should stop and ask me or the TA or one of your classmates how to do it, because they're actually not very long. So if you find that they're taking forever, you're probably doing more work than you need to. So I just wanted to basically begin to show what is a not bad way to proceed with these calculations. So for example, if I want to calculate the Ricci tensor from this, I can start by calculating the Christoffel symbol. So we said that had this formula. So in particular, to calculate this, I'm going to need the inverse metric. So the inverse metric, well, one thing is that if a matrix is not singular, then it's inverse. If a matrix is not singular, then its inverse is unique. So one way to say this is, I just guessed what the inverse was. I mean, it's pretty easy to guess. You can try it if you prefer to do it that way. That's kind of a good exercise to do. But I mean, the other thing is, I give you the inverse in the notes, and if you just check that when you multiply the inverse times this, that the result, you know, if you just check that the inverse given in the notes, G, A, B, that when you multiply it by GBC, that you get delta AC, then that also amounts to showing that that's the inverse. That's the only inverse. And so in particular, again, when I say check it, I mean don't ever split things into, oh yeah, thanks. Wow, that is really great. Wow, is that going to go on the whole lecture? That's going to be huge. Oh, that's really, I really appreciate that. In fact, any other, if you just want to give me more guidance, just not even about erasing, but it's all, you can. Wow, that's awesome. So for example, the key point is that you do not check this equation one component at a time. So let's just for the sake of showing you what I mean. Let me just check that the inverse of this metric. Am I allowed to erase this? Just no. I trust your judgment more than my own. So the inverse metric, which is equation 8 in the new notes, or I think in the old notes too, is so AB. So I want to contract it with something A. So let me contract it with eta upper CA. I mean G upper CA. So this is G lower AB. So I'm going to do this. Okay. CA, AB, and then I'm going to check that it's gives me delta CB. Okay, so G upper CA is eta upper CA. Okay, and because it's just kind of a pain, I'm going to stop writing all these P comma Qs. Minus k xc xa over rho squared. Okay, so now what will happen when I multiply these two things together? So first, eta upper is defined as the inverse of eta lower. What about this guy? Okay. So eta hits eta and gives me the thing that I want. So eta CB. And so then The rest of the terms have to just cancel with one another if I'm going to get the right answer. So let me try this term with this term. A convenient thing here, although I don't want to confuse things. Let me just not do that. So this term with this term gives me minus k xc xa eta ab over rho squared. This term with this term, this eta ca hits this. Oh, whoops. Well, I don't want to. So this, I have to change the name of this dummy index to not confuse things. So let me call this e. What's another letter? I used e and f here. The next letter in the alphabet is g. That's also kind of confusing. I'm going to use g and h, and don't be confused. They're only names of indices. So this is g, and this is h, and this is h. So eta ca hits this eta ag and becomes delta upper c lower g. But then, well, so is that clear? Delta upper c lower g, there's a k in front, times eta bh xg xh over rho squared minus k eta ef xe xf. Okay, and then delta cg multiplying on index g, well, this is just the identity operator. So this just replaces, I can just remove the contracted index here and replace it by c. That's what that expression says. Okay. Did I? Yeah. And then I have one more term. So k times k. If it's zero, then the whole thing is zero. We're really only checking this for k equals plus or minus one. Because if it's zero, then the inverse trivially. So if k is plus or minus one, then k times k is one. Xc times xa hits. So xc xa eta ag eta bh xg xh times rho squared over rho squared minus k. And now, just to simplify notation here, I mean, I don't want to confuse things too much, because if you're not going to confuse yourself by doing it, you can just have to write a lot less by defining x lower b to be eta lower b a x a. But that's confusing, because really, normally you think of lowering the indices with the actual metric, which eta is not here. But you can just save yourself some notational hassle by doing that. Do you have a question?
Yes. Why is the inverse metric different from the normal metric? There's something of a rho squared on the left, but the thing next to it has a rho squared minus k if eta and stuff below the line.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So, I mean, it has to be that for the we'll see that it has to be that to get the answer, to get all these terms to cancel. So if you had had a rho squared minus k eta squared here, minus k x squared. That's what I was going to say. So let me not do this, because this is just like too confusing. But let me define the notation x squared is equal to eta ab xa xb. Is that okay? Even though I want to warn you not to be confused. Usually you would define the inner product of two vectors with respect to the actual metric. That's the physically meaningful thing. This is just a notational convenience to simplify how many indices I have to write down. How many things I have to write down. So I'm going to rewrite this thing as x squared. in answer to your question, if you replace this by rho minus kx, rho squared minus kx squared, and you replace this by rho squared minus kx squared, this expression would not vanish. So, you know, this is what it has to be for this thing to be the inverse. But that's the that's what we're checking. So, and then we have another. Let's see, eta bh only contracts with xh, but eta ag is contracted with an xa and an xg. So I can replace that all by, I can replace that xa, that eta ag, and that xg by just an x squared. See, now I'm just erasing things with my finger instead. I'm unstoppable. Okay. Well, so now I think it's clear that it's a matter of simple algebra. If you multiply, if you put everything over the same denominator, rho squared times rho squared minus kx squared, you multiply by rho squared here, and you multiply by rho squared minus kx squared here. Everything cancels. Do you believe me, or should I go further? Yeah, go ahead.
Is that a way you normally find an inverse metric? You just guess and test the two.
So there's two ways to calculate an inverse. I mean, one is there's a standard linear algebra way to do it, but it's rather involved. So for a 4x4 metric. So in other words, you can tell Mathematica to calculate the inverse of a 4x4 matrix, and it doesn't just guess it. It has some algorithm that it goes through that you once learned in linear algebra. But it gets to be a mess for big matrices. And so for a 4x4 matrix, if the metric is simple enough that you can guess its inverse, and then whenever it's non-singular, whenever its determinant is not zero, then your guess is correct. It is the unique correct answer because for a non-singular matrix, it has a unique inverse. Okay, so this is the sort of thing I have in mind. We're one step away from just showing that when you multiply, when you put everything over the same denominator, that all of these terms cancel and you're left with this. So at no point should you be plugging in C equals 1 or anything like that. Okay.
Question. The pseudo-Cartesian coordinates that you use for a sphere, what part of the sphere would that cover?
Oh, that's a good question. So for the sphere, the coordinates x1 and x2 are these coordinates. That's a very good point. So that, not much of an artist. That's a sphere. So the, and these are these. This is x1, x2, and x3. And we've eliminated x3 in favor of x1 and x2. We've written x3 as plus or minus the square root of rho squared minus x1 squared minus x2 squared. And so we're parameterizing the sphere just in terms of the coordinate in the xy plane. But as Tibor is pointing out, you know, a given coordinate in the xy plane corresponds to two points on the sphere, the point directly above that point in the plane and the point directly below that point in the plane. So in other words, these coordinates really only cover half the sphere, the upper half or the lower half. That's true. So that's an important thing. Usually, when you find a nice coordinate system on a manifold, it will not cover the whole manifold. Often, like in the case of the black hole spacetime, you have to really work like crazy to find coordinate systems that do cover the whole manifold. And in some cases, that is not possible. In fact, in the black hole, forget about that. Thank you. Would you guys all be this good at this? Somehow, did you pick a member of the class with a special talent for next year?
Catherine is the scribe, so.
Okay, yeah. Well, with good reason. So that's a good point. Now, So along those lines, very much along the lines of the calculation that I just did, you can go through and plug in here. Now, when you take a derivative, you have GBD derivative with respect to XC. So GBD, see, you erased something I needed.
You needed everything, though.
B, xA, eta, b, c, xc, rho squared, k, x squared. Now when you're taking the cth derivative of this, it will just kill this. And here, you'll get one term, when you act with the derivative d dxc on this guy, you'll get one term from the d dxc hitting this xA, and that will just turn this thing dxc on xA, that's just equal to delta ac. That's basically the definition of the partial derivative. You're taking the derivative of that coordinate with respect to itself, holding all other coordinates fixed. And then delta AC, that will just mean that you can replace in that term this, you can just then erase the delta AC as long as you find the other A appearing in that term and replace it by a C. So you'll get one term like that, you'll get another term like that, and then in the denominator you'll get is it clear? The thing that will save you algebra there is just that every time the derivative acts, it ultimately acts on another coordinate xA and just converts it into a delta AC or delta whatever. Maybe I will say so. There are two terms like that: a term from the derivative acting in here, a term from the derivative acting on there. Let me just for the sake of making sure no one is. So I'm taking ddc of this guy. So I get one term, which is eta ba delta ac eta dc xc. Whoops, call this thing. And then another term. That looks like this is really I just don't even know what to say about that. And this term we simplify by just replacing that A with a C. That's what the delta AC lets us do. And this term we simplify by replacing that E with a C. And then there's one other term from the derivative acting on the denominator here. So that looks like minus, and then the denominator squared, and then the derivative of the denominator itself, that's a constant, and so the derivative of the denominator itself is minus k times the derivative of this thing with respect to xc, but this thing is, xg, xh, eta gh, and so ddc of that is, Since this is symmetric, the term that I get from ddc acting on this is going to just be equal to the term that I get from ddc acting on this. So let's just take the one from ddc acting on this. That'll give me a delta gc, which will convert that eta from a g into a c, and then the xh will still be there. So 2 x, h, eta, c, h. Okay, so anyway, if you proceed in this way, it's really just a few lines to get the expression very simple expression which I quote in the notes. And it's just a good exercise in doing GR calculations and not letting them get out of hand. Okay, so gamma BC is just proportional to GBC times XA over rho squared times K. And that is, remember, this thing is not a tensor. So this simple expression is only true in this coordinate system. But then when you go ahead and calculate, you know, the Riemann tensor in terms of our formula with four gamma terms like that, then you get this. Then you get the other expression that I quoted. You get this expression that it's proportional to the product of the matrix with indices A, C, B, D minus A, D, B, C. And then that's an equation between two tensors. So once you've done that, everything beyond that is valid in any coordinate system. You've obtained a coordinate independent identity that holds for all these spacetimes. And that is really the very convenient thing to take away. Any future analysis you will ever want to do of these spacetimes, once you've derived that formula once, I recommend to you that any future calculation you will want to do with these spacetimes and the geometry of them can always be done starting with that formula, the formula for the Riemann tensor in terms of the product of the two metrics. You will feel that you have derived it. You will feel no uncertainty in your stomach about using the formula. So problem one is just to go through and check those few equations. So now let's quickly just sketch what these spacetimes look like and talk about them for a moment. So first, the sphere it always looks like some generalization of the sphere you know. The hyperboloid, what does that look like? A good thing to check that I recommend you to check is that if you solve for the two hyperboloid, what that looks like is, well, remember the embedding space there has one minus sign in it, has one time-like direction, whereas this embedding space was Euclidean space, but to get the two sphere. But the two hyperboloid, it was embedded in a space with one time-like direction. So let this be the time-like direction, or the x3 direction, whatever you want to call it. And then the surface that we define that's embedded in that space-time is a hyperboloid that asymptotes to the light cone. And in fact, there's two hyperboloids, really, that are the solution to that equation. What you're ultimately solving for, the metric that you're solving for, the coordinates only cover one of these hyperboloids. So usually when you talk about the n hyperboloid, you're usually referring to this one. And in the Friedman, Robertson, Walker case, when we make use of the n hyperboloid as a possible spatial geometry that evolves in time, you know, we're just talking about one copy of this. So the radius of curvature here is just is this distance here. This is the negatively curved spacetime that you should imagine. Notice that it's always the slope here is always it asymptotes to 45 degrees, but it's always less than 45 degrees. So this is always a purely spatial surface, just like the sphere is over here. You're supposed to imagine that this is rotated around the axis. And whereas De Sitter space is another thing to sort of draw for yourself what the solution looks like. Again, the embedding space there has one as I don't even know, I don't even, you understand better than me what's being erased or not erased, but the again, the embedding space has one. Time-like direction, so it's basically some sort of Minkowski space. And now the solution in the de Sitter case looks like it's a thing like this. But again, asymptotes to the light cone, but it's always a little bit steeper than a light cone. So that means everywhere. So it's really a space-time. Unlike this guy, which even though it's in the same embedding space, it's always shallower than the light cone, so it's always a purely spatial manifold. This thing is always a little bit steeper than the light cone, so it always has one time-like direction, just like the embedding space. And here, this upper surface is disconnected from this lower surface. But in the de Sitter case, these things, the surface we're talking about here, looks like this. Okay, so it's some hourglass thing, so that's what de Sitter space looks like. So in particular, one coordinate system that we'll find on de Sitter space looks, for example, when I say that the universe today looks like de Sitter space, I of course mean it looks like a four-dimensional de Sitter space. So the embedding space would be five-dimensional. So here I've drawn a three-dimensional embedding space and a two-dimensional surface. And you see that if we take the time coordinate to just run up in this direction, so these are different, each of those circles are different time slices of this manifold. In this lower dimensional version, the remaining thing at that time slice is a one sphere, right? Namely a circle, which I've drawn here. But if you beef this diagram up by two more directions that I can't draw, then at each time slice, it's a three-sphere that's collapsing, which I can't visualize. So four-dimensional de Sitter space, one way to think of it is that it's this three-sphere that starts out at infinity, collapses into a minimum radius rho, and then expands out again. And that's what an FRW space-time will look like. So that's a particular coordinate system that you can take on de Sitter space, which makes it look like an FRW space-time. So we're about to get to FRW space-times. But I mean, an FRW space-time will be a space-time that at every spatial slice looks like some maximally symmetric manifold. So here we said that at this spatial slice it looks like a sphere. So that's an example of one of these maximally symmetric manifolds. And so it looks like a FRW universe just with a very particular special contraction and expansion history that happens to give it a bigger symmetry than a normal FRW universe. So with that said, let's just go ahead to maybe let me just say one more thing to give one more bit of intuition about what positive and negative curvature means. So, on the blackboard, if I draw a triangle, the angles sum up to 180 degrees, but that's because the blackboard is flat. If I draw a triangle on the sphere, you know, you've probably all seen this, let's say I take the straightest possible, shortest possible path from point one to point two, and then I make a 90 degree turn here, and I go along the equator, and then I make another 90-degree turn. I go 90 degrees, and I make another 90-degree turn and go back up to the initial point, moving always along the geodesics of the sphere, which happen to be the great circles. In other words, the largest possible circles. Then, at every vertex here, I have a 90-degree angle, and so the total angles add up to 270 degrees. And so this is a general feature of positively curved spaces that the angles of a triangle add up to more than 180 degrees, and then on the hyperboloid it's the opposite way. The angles of the triangle in general at up to less than 180 degrees. And so if you projected them on the blackboard, it would look like, you know, something like this. Another thing that may be useful to keep in mind, just to get some intuition about what positively versus negatively curved spaces mean, because again, you know, the whole idea, one of the sort of triumphs of cosmology was figuring out what is the geometry of the cosmology that we live on, you know, the spatial slices that we live on. What are they open or closed? Are they negatively curved or positively curved, or do they have zero curvature? And when you're trying to figure out what observation you could do to work that out, it's good to have some intuition for what these spaces look like. So another thing is that if you draw a circle of radius r on the blackboard, that its circumference is 2 pi r. But you can see on the sphere that that's not going to be true. If you go out a distance r here, and then draw the circle at that radius, and you go out a distance r in all directions from the cap, it's clear that circle is going to have a smaller radius than if you had just drawn your gone straight out a distance r, and drawn that circle instead. Right? And again, it goes the opposite way. So for a given radius of the circle on a positively curved space, the circumference is smaller than you would have expected. On a negatively curved space, the opposite. Okay. So with that in mind, let's do FRW. FRW stands for Friedman, Robertson, Walker, who are some of the early discoverers of this metric. I think there's this other guy, Lemaître, who maybe, I don't really know who discovered it first. Maybe Friedman. I think they did it independently, though. But Lemaître gets shafted. He definitely did something important, but he doesn't get mentioned. The idea of Friedman, Robertson, Walker is to generalize what's happening here. That I build my universe from a stack of spatial slices. So this is the time direction. So, once upon a time, before when Einstein had first invented general relativity, but before he knew what the universe around him looked like, he assumed that what Copernicus had learned, that the Earth was not the center of the solar system, but a more or less random spot in the solar system, he assumed that should be generalized to the so-called cosmological principle, that we don't live in some special point in the universe, So his formulation of the cosmological principle was even a little bit stronger. It was that he assumed that the universe should be essentially the same to any observer anywhere in space or in time. It should look more or less the same to any such observer. So then that quickly turned out to not be true. Observations quickly began to show that actually, the universe in the past looked different than the universe today, and so you had to give up that strongest principle in the face of observations. But then there was a weaker principle which people held on to, and which is held up to observations to this day, which is that although the universe looks different in the past and will look different in the future than it looks today, that at least statistically speaking, it looks the same at a given time at any point in space. So at this moment, another observer looking out, 2 billion light years away from us, or 10 billion light years away from us, is seeing a universe with essentially the same properties, the universe expanding at the same rate. Yeah.
When you say at this moment, that implies an existence of a global time, right? So that implies certain properties of the metric that you're talking about.
Yes, that's true. So are you worried that I'm going to claim that this is the most too general?
I'm just pointing out that there is an implicit assumption whenever we say at this point in time.
Yeah, that's true.
There's another observer.
I see. You mean that implies that I've already cut the space time up into time.
Right.
And that's actually a very good point. I've already been using, there's a natural time coordinate. You know, if you have a space-time such that it can be sliced up into slices, each of which is a maximally symmetric surface, then, well, I could take whatever, you know, coordinate system I wanted to on this thing. I could take my time, you know, running like this, and my spatial coordinates running like this. But a nicer thing to do, everything becomes nicer if I choose my spatial coordinates to lie along these totally symmetric surfaces, and my time coordinate to tell me how I'm moving from one such surface to the next. And so you're absolutely right, that when I say people at the same time are observing the same thing, it's absolutely true I'm already assuming when I say that the space-time has this structure, and that the time coordinate that I'm referring to is one that is constant along these maximally symmetric surfaces. So each of these surfaces, I've drawn it as a little straight line, but so really it could be, we, as far as we know, live in 3+1 dimensional space, macroscopically, which in the universe is very macroscopic. But what I have in mind is this line is representing a three-dimensional sphere, three-dimensional Euclidean space, or the three-dimensional hyperboloid. Okay, so this are just ordinary flat space. And then what we'll see later is that observations have increasingly driven us to understand that, in fact, it turns out that the spatial geometry is very close to this special intermediate case with zero curvature. And that was one of the original motivations for inflation, or in any case, it's one of the basic puzzles, as we'll see, about the universe that needs to be explained by something or other. Let's imagine for concreteness that each of these, that what we're looking at here is, so now instead of a space-time diagram, I'm going to do some sort of, let's say that our universe was this, just for visualization purposes. So it's some three sphere at each time, but then it can expand or contract. Any of these spaces can at a later time stretch or contract, and they can, since there's no particular symmetry in the time direction, they can stretch or contract in some more or less arbitrary way, parameterized by some scale factor A of t. So if A of t goes from A1 at time t1, so to A2 at time t2, that means between time t1 and t2, this sphere, or whichever surface, has expanded by a factor of A2 over A1. So if A2 is twice A1, the whole space has doubled in time between time t1 and t2. And so if you're a little guy, if this is the surface of a balloon that you're blowing up, and you know you don't know anything about the interior of the balloon, you just know about the surface of the balloon. The universe that you live on is, so we'll see in a moment, but I mean not in a moment, we'll see in the next lecture that in fact, if you draw little dots on the surface of the balloon, that massive particles time-like observers can just sit at those dots as the balloon expands. That is a time-like geodesic of the metric. And those are the so-called co-moving observers, the observers who just sit at one point on the surface of the balloon as the balloon expands or contracts with time. And if they look out at the other co-moving observers, and again, they don't really look out at constant time. You have to actually, you know, detect some light from those observers. So it's a fudge to say that to really think of observing the other guys at the same moment in time. But the bottom line is that as the balloon expands, everybody sees everybody else expanding away from them in the same way. Every observer who looks out here sees the same thing. They see their nearest neighbors. They see everybody's gotten twice as far away from them, and the nearest neighbors are the amount of distance that they had to cover to get twice as far away is not that much, because they weren't that far away in the first place. But the very distant neighbors, for them to get twice as far away in the same amount of time, they had to move much further, and so those more distant observers appear to be receding faster. Anyway, this is just some introductory intuition about kind of what these FRW space times are doing. They're just these maximally symmetric surfaces stretching with time. And so I ask, very much in analogy to the first section of the notes, I just outline. I'm not going to get to black holes at all. So I just outlined the calculation of the curvature tensor for these metrics. And the calculation is very close to the calculation for the maximally symmetric spacetimes. And the end result of that calculation, you start with a metric, which is minus dt squared. It's just the formula implementing the physics that I just described. So now let's talk about n plus 1. Now I'll use n to refer to, in the FRW spacetime, plus use n to just refer to the dimension of the maximally symmetric surface, which is not the dimension of the spacetime as a whole, but just the dimension of the space. So we're talking, so we live in n plus 1 dimensional FRW geometry with n equals 3, for example. So the FRW metric looks like minus dt squared plus a squared of t. This so far arbitrary scale factor, this thing is called the scale factor, if I didn't mention that, that represents, depending on how the function a of t changes with time, that just encodes how the three-dimensional geometry is expanding or contracting with time. In a way that will be determined by the matter content in the space-time, times some three-dimensional maximally symmetric metric of purely positive signature. So this is the what we would have previously called the p comma q is 3 comma 0, and then k can again be plus or minus 1 or 0. But this is the metric. This is the maximally symmetric metric derived in the first part of the notes. So, the only difference between calculating the Christoffel symbols and the Ricci tensor. And now here, by the way, so the only difference are the following two things. The calculation is very similar to the previous one that I described, except that whereas in the previous one you never had to make any differentiation between the different indices, you never had to set index c is equal to 1 or 3 or whatever. Here, you do have to treat the time direction different than the space direction. So you have to calculate separately, you know, gamma 0 I, where I is one of the spatial directions, 1, 2, 3, or, you know, gamma I, j, where these are both spatial directions. So, but you never specify a particular spatial direction, but you do now, because there's less symmetry, as everywhere in physics. Less symmetry means you have to calculate a little bit more. You have to break this into the components into whether they're a zero component or an I component. Anyway, so the other problem on the problem set is to go through the calculation that I've outlined in the problems that I've outlined here. So I give formulae in the notes for what all the Christoffel symbols are, and then what the components of the Ricci tensor are. And thank you. And another thing I should say is that there's really you should go directly to calculating the Ricci tensor. You should not calculate the Riemann tensor first. That's just a waste of effort, because it turns out that the only non-zero components of the Riemann tensor are the components that appear in the Ricci tensor. So all the extra stuff you would be calculating over here is just there's no extra information over here. All those extra bits turn out to be zero for FRW spacetime. So in other words, just go directly to take your formula. Once you've calculated the gammas, the connections, the connection coefficients, and you're going to plug into your formula for R in terms of the gammas. Just don't plug it in in general. Use the formula with C at set equal to A right from the get-go. So this is the formula for RBD. Okay, and then once you've calculated the components of RBD, and there's only two. There's only two independent ones really, and you can see that. So you calculate these guys, and then from there it's a short route to plug into the Einstein equations. And here we will discuss why this is later, but for FRW spacetimes, the symmetry of the spacetime ends up requiring that if you write P in upper mu, lower nu form, that it's just a diagonal 4x4 matrix where the zeroth component is minus the energy density, so the energy per unit volume, which could be some function of time, but is not a function of space because it's a homogeneous universe. And then the other n spatial components are all P plus P of P. And so when you bring this index down to plug it into this formula, you have T00 is equal to plus rho and T0i is equal to 0 and Tij is equal to plus P Gij. If I'm not making an error. So anyway, you plug this in and you find that there's only two independent equations that you get out. One of them is, and those things are both crucially important. So again, I encourage you to derive it once, feel like you know where they come from, and then forever on, never derive them again. Just use them. And so one of them turns out to be the Friedmann equation. And the other one is the so-called continuity equation.
In the notes, you've got a plus 2 lambda. Does it matter?
Oh, yeah, you're right. It's plus 2 lambda. No, that doesn't. You're absolutely. So these are very useful equations. And in particular, of course, so it is useful to have, there's no extra trouble in keeping n general in the derivation. There's no extra algebra that you have to do. Everything is just the same. But of course, at the end of the day, for most cosmological applications, you will set n equal to our actual number of macroscopic spatial dimensions, 3. And so it's probably useful to just remember what the, or just see what the, what the, Thanks. Okay, so what this says is that I maybe I'll just let me just say in words. So, you know, this is saying that so H is called the Hubble expansion rate. And it is A dot over A. So in other words, that is dA dt. A dot is dA dt over A. Or in other words, it's the time derivative, it's the rate at which log A is growing. So it's basically it's something about at a given moment in time, h of t tells you how fast is the universe expanding at that moment in time. And this equation, the Friedman equation, says the more energy density there is in the universe, the faster it expands. The more energy density there is at that time, the faster it expands at that time. If there's a positive cosmological constant, that makes it expand a little bit faster. If there's a negative cosmological constant, that would make it expand a little bit slower. If there is a positive curvature, so if the universe is a, if the three-dimensional surface is a sphere, this minus sign says that positive curvature makes the universe expand a little bit slower for a given fixed amount of energy density, whereas negative curvature means that the universe is expanding a little bit faster for a given fixed amount of energy density. So, this guy, meanwhile, is telling you that if the energy density and pressure at a given time are, let's say, positive, for most types of things, both their energy density and pressure are positive, although the cosmological constant is an example of something that acts not like that, or vacuum energy, I should say. There are things that are not like that, but most ordinary matter, like the universe is filled with protons that are floating around, or if the universe is filled with relativistic particles, radiation, photons, and like the early universe is, these things are both positive. And so then this minus sign says that the energy density tells you that how fast the energy density is dropping as a function of time depends on what rho and drops faster when rho and t are bigger. Okay, so these guys together, in combination with the equation of state, the relationship for if you know how rho, what rho is for many things, if you tell me p, that's enough to give rho, or vice versa. And so in such a case, you then have enough, this forms a closed set of equations to figure out how the universe evolves in time. So that's one of that question of what the dynamics is of the expansion as a function of what matter content is in the universe is one of the things that we will be discussing in the next lecture. And then we also need to understand the kinematics, just what do particles moving through the space-time do? What do people living in the space-time see? So anyway, that's the subject of next lecture. I didn't get to black holes at all. Crashing. So the idea originally was to give a brief introduction to black holes and then leave a couple exercises and notes for covering in the tutorial. Unfortunately, it appears that everything about black holes will be left for the tutorial. So. Have I already run over?
About 2 minutes.
So.
Are you planning to do black holes tomorrow, or were you planning?
Maybe I will do a little bit. Maybe I will cover a little bit of black holes tomorrow. I don't want to push back.
Yeah.
technology too much, but
You guys saw the Schwarzschild metric in Neil's course, right? And also the Kerr metric, right? So it won't be too much of a stretch to kind of revisit that without being able to lectures.
Yeah. Okay. I will just give the
but if you
completely a completely non-technical, but just you know what is the So maybe the first 10 minutes of the next lecture I'll talk about black holes, but then we'll be moving on to technology.
I'll put up the homework assignment on the wiki in, after lunch. I couldn't access the internet from here, so it's down.
Okay, yeah, I get that.
They don't have gravitational physics and quantum.